Alrighty, now it gives me great pleasure to introduce Turtle from Lompoc.
Wow. Hi, guys. My name's Turtle and I'm an alcoholic. What a long, strange trip it's been. I've been here for a while. My sobriety date's January 5th, 1986. And in less than 90 days, I will be celebrating 40 years of continuous sobriety from all mind-altering substances. Anyway, I won't go into that. But, I was looking for a 30-year chip this morning for a friend of mine that's going to turn 30 on the 1st of November. And I was looking through my thing of chips, and I ran across my Pinecrest chip. Now, some of you guys know about CRC in Santa Barbara, yes. Cottage Residential Center. Well, it used to be called Pinecrest. When I went through there in 1986, it was Pinecrest, and this is my chip that I got when I graduated there. And I thought I had lost it, so it was in that basket, and so I put it in my pocket. Because I wanted to bring it here to remind me. And Cora was around when I came into these rooms. And Billy was around when I came into these rooms, you know. And I got sober in Santa Barbara. And I went through Pinecrest back then I was in the outpatient program. And, you know, I had this amazing adventure before I got here, and I've had an amazing adventure since I walked through these doors. One thing, not just one thing, I mean, the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is grace and integrity, honesty, kindness, compassion, self-reflection, non-judgment. These are just a few of the things that I have learned since I have been here. And these are things that I practice on a daily basis. And I do none of them perfectly. You know, in these rooms, I always feel at home. I always feel liked. I always feel loved. And I never feel judged. Out there is a completely different story. I work in recovery. I've been working in the field of addiction and mental health for the last 38 years. And I do that minimally today. I work for CADA, which is Council on Alcoholism and Drug Addiction, and I do clinical supervision, not for the clients, only for the counselors. But they too, I can have a bad day, and they know, right? We know, we have this sense about each other, and we understand, and we see a look and a mood, and we understand. And when there's conflict, we do this first. In these rooms, we do this first. My other job is not so much like that on the psychiatric unit, because most of the people that work there, they're not in this program. And so they don't say, oh, what's my part? They at all. You know, and so that's very different. And it makes me do my work. You know, it makes me do my work. Now, the adventures that I have had here have been amazing. When I came in here, I wanted a Harley. I've had four. I don't have one right now. And that's sad because I want one again. So, but this time what I think I'm going to do, because see, I get to do what I want to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get to have the life that I want to have. And I get to create my own reality in that way. So what I want to do is I want to buy a basket. I want to buy an old basket, I want to get a frame, and I want to build one myself. And I'd like to find an old knucklehead. Maybe Cora can come over and help me, just, you know. Find an old wishbone frame and put it together, and wow, wouldn't that be cool? See, back in the day, when you could actually take a Harley apart and put it back together again on your own steam, it didn't have jet this and jet that and fuel injected and all this crap, right? It was like an old 57 Chevy. You could take it apart and put it back together again. You didn't take it to the shop, right? So back in the day. So I'm coming up on 40 years sober, which also means I'm coming up on 73 years alive on this planet. And I'm amazed at that. I'm amazed that I'm still here standing after all these years. You know, I'm amazed at that. And my life started in Berkeley in 1953. And, you know, I grew up in a crazy house, like a lot of us did. And I had a non-present father that was emotionally vacant. I had a mom that was very narcissistic and held me up on a pedestal and put my sister under the bus. You know, she loved me. I was her reflection. My sister was not so much her reflection, and she got the worst of that. And then, of course, she got the worst of it because I was the black sheep. I was the crazy one. And I was the one that left, and I was the one that demanded all the attention, and I was the one that got the attention, right? So I have been able to, you know, come to terms with all of that, make amends to all of that. I didn't realize what I had done to my family because of my drinking and using. And my journey starts very early. My stepfather was a crazy Italian alcoholic, and I got tired of him chasing my mother down the hallway with a butcher knife while she was naked. I got tired of those kind of scenes. I got tired of being invisible. So at the age of 12, and let me back up a little bit, because I don't want to get into it a lot, but at the age of, I have childhood sexual trauma. At the age of 5, I was raped, or 4 and a half. I was raped, not molested. It's so nice, that word, molested. I was raped. I was put in the hospital for 5 days, a week, 5 days, because of that incident. And what happened was I stopped eating. Now, this is I was born in 53, so if you look at 1958, they swept that under the carpet. That went under the carpet. And so I stopped eating, and the doctor's solution for me not eating was to give me a glass of Christian Brothers port wine before each meal. That would build my appetite, right? Well, it did. And it taught me how to not feel a damn thing. Have a feeling, take a drink. Have a feeling, eat a cookie. Have a feeling, hit somebody. Have a feeling, get angry. All of these chemical responses that I was getting at the age of 5. So at the age of 12, I found an old army blanket, and I had a purple velvet sash that I tied around that with my stuff in it, and I put it around my neck, and I walked out the door. I walked out the door, and I never went back. I went to Telegraph Avenue. I went to Haight-Ashbury. I lived on the streets. And I had fun. I had fun. The 60s were a blast. Country Joe and the Fish were playing in the park across the street from the police station. Sergeant Sunshine was giving out LSD to anybody that would take it. Joan Baez and Bob Dylan were playing at the amphitheater on campus for $5. Together for $5. I was at the Monterey Pop Festival. That was the first place Janis Joplin ever got signed to a contract, was at the Monterey Pop Festival, and Grace Slick was there, and it was full of Hell's Angels, who I just loved at the age of 12. I was going around getting their signatures. Can I have your signature? Can I have your signature? Can I have your signature? And I was a brazen kid. I was so brazen. And I I found out, you know, I loved Harley Davidson's. That's just the sound of, and those of you that know, there's nothing like shifting gears in a Harley and feeling that vibration go up your spine. That nothing compares to that. And I just love that. So I thought, I want to meet Sonny Barger. That's what I wanted to do. And so I knew where he lived. He lived on Golf Links Road in Oakland. And so I went to his house. There was a situation that had taken place, and somebody told me that the Hell's Angels, this is crazy, this is years ago, had a contract out on me. This, it was not true, of course, right? I was 12. So I go to his house. There's chain link around the house. There's Dobermans in the front yard, and I'm yelling, "Hey, Sonny! Ralph, come on out!" And his old lady comes out and goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I need to talk to him. I think I'm in trouble with you guys." She laughed at me. And she invited me in. And guess what I did that day? I spent the day in the garage with Sonny Barger, handing him tools and learning how to tune the bike, working on his 900cc Harley. That's what he had, 900cc Harley. And then I left at the end of the day and I never went back there. But it was, it got me in this place where I knew that I had to have a Harley Davidson. And I didn't get that first Harley until I got sober. So that's what sobriety got me. It got me my first Harley. I also joined a club in sobriety, Fifth Chapter Motorcycle Club, Santa Barbara. I was the president of that club at one point before we all got rolled up and told to go away and take our toys and go play someplace else. Because we weren't playing very nice. So, you know, I spent a lot of time when I was younger on Telegraph Avenue and Film Auditorium, and, you know, I took hits off of Janis Joplin's Southern Comfort bottle in the Fillmore Auditorium. It cost $5 to get in there to see them, too. There was nothing like the 60s. Nothing like the 60s. Watching Jimi Hendrix smash his guitar into the speaker, which is what he did almost at every concert at the Coliseum. And so those years were so amazing to me. And I never went back home. My sister caught me on Telegraph Avenue. She was 5 years older than I was. And she caught me on Telegraph Avenue. And I guess she waited for a cop or something, because she brought a cop into the coffee shop where I was hanging out. I think it was a pizza shop where I was hanging out. There was Cody's Bookstore, La Fiesta Restaurant, Bank of America, which got blown up, Berkeley Inn that was behind it. And my sister came in and said, "That's my sister. And she's been missing for 3 years. At that time, I was 15. But my mother had never called the police. I wasn't missing. My mom never called the cops when I left home. It was easier for me to be gone because her life was a mess, right? So I ended up getting arrested. But, you know, there were some things that happened before that. I don't know if you guys remember. Is there anybody from the Bay Area here? Anybody in their 70s? No? Nobody?
I'm in my 70s.
Yeah, Bay Area, People's Park Riot. We put up this park. There was a park behind behind the main street, and we put up this park. And one day we all got up in the morning, and the park had a cyclone fence around it, and there was a three-day riot. And we turned over cop cars, and we got there. There were stations where the cops were and the National Guard, and they had big bags of oranges, and we took their bags of oranges, and we injected them with LSD, and we put them back. Wow. We did that. It was fun. It was fun. It was the 60s. And there was not consequences for things like this. The world was different back then. Nobody was carrying guns. Nobody was hurting each other. People were handing out free food, free medical food. There was a free med place. There was free food, free places to crash, all over the place. But when I got busted that day at 15, I went to juvenile hall. And before the cops took me, I had 6 hits of chocolate mescaline in my back pocket when they came in. Guess what I did? I took them all. Ooh. I took them all. I loved that drug. I loved psychedelics. I took a lot of psychedelics. I drank a lot of alcohol. And I took a lot of drugs. I smoked a lot of pot. But it was different back then. The world was different back then. I didn't feel like I was in danger. You could hitchhike anywhere, go anywhere. You didn't have to be afraid. There was no reason to be afraid back then like there is today. I can't imagine being a 12-year-old and leaving home today and being on the streets. I cannot imagine that. You would have to sell your soul in order to do that. And I know a lot of them have, because I've worked with the teenagers in Santa Barbara County, and I know what they go through. And so I ended up going to, my mom came to court, and I was signed over and made a ward of the court at 15, and I got the choice between California Youth Authority until I was 25 or Synanon. Anybody in here know about Synanon? Synanon was a cult, and it was not a nice place to be, and it got worse after I was there. So I chose Synanon because I knew that the doors were not locked. And so I went to Synanon, and I stayed there for a while. I didn't stay very long. I didn't want to be there. It was so crazy. That place was just absolutely nuts. I mean, we had this thing called the hoopla and the dance, and
they had contracts to have sex, and they had sex rooms. It was a cult. And they sent this 15-year-old kid to a cult. This is my first experience of recovery, of not drinking, of not using. And they put this 15-year-old child into this place in downtown Oakland with people that were all of them over 21. I was the only one that was under 18 in that place. And so it was really scary for me. And so I left because there was an open door. I left. I went back to Telegraph Avenue. I ended up turning myself in. And they called my mom and my stepdad, and my mom said, no, she can't come home. So again, I had to go back to juvenile hall and then back to Synanon. They decided they would take me back. When they took me back, I had to sit on a bench in the front. You know those old Catholic school benches, right? Hard benches. I had to sit on that bench for 24 hours to get back in. They stuck a stocking cap on my head with all my hair up inside of it. They put a sign around my neck that said, I am a 15-year-old dummy. Do not talk to me. I must spend 13 hours working to work off a contract of 30 days. I can't. It said other stuff on it. So I stayed for a few days, I think, 3 or 4 days. And then they gave me a toothbrush. And they gave me a can of Comet, you know, those big industrial kitchens with the red tiles and the grout in between. And they told me to scrub the grout in between in this big, giant industrial kitchen that housed 1,000 people. Because that downtown, it was kind of kitty-corner to the Doggy Diner. I don't know if you remember the Doggy Diner in downtown
Santa
Oakland.
Monica.
Yeah. Oh, in Santa Monica, Synanon? On
yes.
The beach, yes.
Yeah, but I wasn't in it. It was there.
It was there. Well, it was so much fun. I'm glad you didn't go there. So, I was the one in downtown Oakland. So they gave me the brush to do that, and I said, you know, you can take this brush and you can put it where the sun don't shine, because I'm not doing it. And I didn't want to get in trouble for running away. I didn't want to get in trouble again. So I went and I stood out front on the porch. I stood out front on the porch of that place, and I waited for a cop car to come by. And I'm waving. Come, come, come. He says, come here. I said, no, not leaving these steps unless I'm escorted. So he took me. He came up and he got me and he took me. And I had to go to juvenile hall. The next place I went to was a place called Koinonia Community, which was a Christian organization in Santa Cruz, California. And I moved into this house up on the beach across from Cal's Beach. This big giant Victorian thing with the cross up on the top of it. And there was a coffee shop, and there was another place called the Catalyst Club that was also in Santa Cruz. And they were kind of the rival to Koinonia Community, right? Koinonia means Christian community, which they were not. So that we sat around and we prayed one night, and they prayed for the demise of the Catalyst Club. And the next day, the Catalyst Club was burnt to the ground. So, and I was blown away by that. And so I called my probation officer and I said, you got to get me out of here. This place is just crazy. I can't stay here. And so my aunt that lived up in Auburn was willing to take foster custody of me. So I went to live with my aunt up in Auburn. And those were some really good years up there. We had horses, and I got to go riding. But I still drank all the time, and I still took a lot of acid. I remember one night, my cousin and I, we both took some acid, and we were in my bedroom. And my aunt's like, what are you guys doing up there? Because we kept flushing the toilet because it sounded so funny. And we were like, she's a knock it off. So I stayed there until I turned 18. But later, I think it was like 4 or 5 months later, my mom sent me an article that was in the newspaper. Koinonia Community got busted for misuse of state funds and practicing Satanism with minors. So this is another place of an introduction to recovery that I got as a teenager. It wasn't very fun to me, right? It wasn't very fun. At 18, I left my aunt's house. I was off probation by that time. And I ended up in Santa Barbara County. When I was 18, I ended up here. I got married to my first husband in Santa Barbara County. And we drank and we used. And I left him, right? Because we drank and we used, and it ruined our relationship and it ruined our marriage. We were getting ready to come up, go to San Francisco, and that didn't happen. We were actually living in Van Nuys when I got married, and then we were ready to go to San Francisco with our dog, Tonga, and this is where the car broke down. And this is where it was supposed to break down, because I had three more husbands to meet here. Cora knows about all of that. You know, I've been married 4 times. I've had a couple of relationships in between that, but not many. Most of the men that I've slept with in my life, I have married. It's just kind of who I am. So, but my first husband, Tom, he died in 2011, but we were not together. We broke up when I was like 19, 20, something like that. My second husband, Craig, who I had, we had a son together when I was 23. Craig had hair down to his ass, and he looked like a picture of Jesus Christ. And he had this crazy Harley with this extended front end that was off the hook. And I fell in love with him because he was a biker. That's the name of that. And we had a son together. His name was John Lewis. And he died when he was 4 days old. He had a massive brain hemorrhage. It's still hard for me to talk about that. That emotion comes up. You know, that will always forever have a scar, a wound in my heart, a brokenness. And I know I'm not the only person in this room that knows about that kind of brokenness. And so I had to leave him. I couldn't stay. I couldn't stay and be with someone who knew that, and all the people that knew that my son had died. And it was a reflection and a reminder, and I couldn't be around it. So I left, and on my 25th birthday, I walked into the office bar on Lower State Street, and I met Roger. Roger I did not marry, but Roger I spent 6 years with. And my husband at the time, Craig, that I had the baby with, was at my house because it was my birthday. He was at our house, and he was throwing me a surprise party that I didn't show up for because I got drunk in the office bar and went home with Roger. You know, this is just alcoholic stuff, crazy stuff, right? So I went home with Roger, and then I came home at 3 o'clock in the morning in a blackout. And Craig was like, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm over at someone's house. What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I gave you a party, and there's people all over the house." And I left. I went back with Roger. I went back with Roger because it was too noisy at my house. So I went back with Roger. And that's where I stayed for the next 6 years, you know. I stayed there for the next 6 years. And then that was in the office bar, and that's where I met John. I met John, my next husband. He was the bartender in the office bar on Lower State Street. And we got married at Club Iguana, which was 2 doors up. And at the time, you know, when I met him, I was living at the Schooner Inn, if anybody remembers the Schooner Inn. Cora does, yeah. You remember the Schooner Inn. I was living at the Schooner Inn. It was a great room because I had the top room, looked out over the parades. I got to see the parade. It was cool. So I was there and I met John. He was the bartender, and I think it was his birthday. His birthday was the 24th of March. Mine is the 31st of March. And I said, "What are you doing? My name's Turtle." And he said, "Well, I'm trying to tend bar." And I had a bunch of Hershey's Kisses, and I said, and I handed him one. I said, "Do you want a kiss?" And he said, "Yeah." And I reached over and I grabbed a whole handful, and I said, "You want to make out?" And John went home with me that night to the Schooner Inn, and we ended up getting married at Club Iguana next door. Now, John is my angel. John is the only one of my husbands that is still living. He lives in Florida, and he's married to a lovely woman, and he's finally sober. He's sober 25 years now, so he had to go back out. He went out, and he got loaded again. He went out, and he started stealing, and I had to ask him to leave, because that is not why I got sober. Of course, he left, and then I hooked up with Yahoo from that outlaw biker club. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about that here. I'm not going to talk about that. But, you know, it's part of the adventure of being clean and sober, right? We don't do everything perfectly, and it's supposed to be an adventure to be lived, not a problem to be solved. Correct? Correct. So, you know, I kind of was flailing for a little while, and then the fifth chapter started in Santa Barbara, and I had just gotten my first Harley, my 86. God, I love that bike. That was simpatico. That was like I was one with that motorcycle. I wish I hadn't sold it. Anyway, I've had three others since then, and now I don't have any of them because I sold them. So I'm going to get another one. I've already told that story. So I met Jerry, and Jerry was my rocking chair buddy. Jerry and I, 1991, we got married, and we went to, we ended up moving up to Lompoc in 91, and Jerry was sober when I met him. He was at Newhouse too when I met him. And he kept relapsing, and he kept relapsing, and he kept relapsing. And finally, and I at this time, I'm working as a counselor at Cottage Hospital, and people say, well, why can't you keep your husband sober? I'm like, do you realize how stupid that sounds? How am I supposed to keep him sober? I would put him in detox. He would get home. I would go to the bathroom. I would come out. He would be gone. Because he loved me. He worshipped the ground that I walked on. But guess what? You guys know the story. Drugs were bigger than that love, and it didn't make any difference. And in 2006, I had to ask him to leave. And so he left. And of course, we kept talking back and forth. 2006, I took a jackhammer to my life. I quit a job at Cottage Hospital. In the interim of this, I've been working as a counselor in Cottage Hospital for 18 years in the chemical dependency unit. And in 2006, I quit that job. I had been at Cottage a total of 30 years when I quit that job. I kicked Jerry out. I hooked up with he whose name shall never be spoken. Yeah. And I put my house up for sale. I did this all within a two-week period, guys. I put my house up for sale. I packed everything I had, and I moved to Washington with he whose name shall not be spoken. That went to hell in a handbasket. I lost my best friend, Joanne, up in Washington because of that, because this person that I was with was really sick, and he was a narcissist, but he was one of us. And I thought, in my heart of hearts, I thought, I can fix him. Right? I can fix him. I can help him get better. There was nothing that I could do to make his life any different. Any different. And I lost a lot in that. I lost money in that. I lost $100,000 in that transaction. And it's okay. It's just money. You can't take it with you, you know? And so there was a lot that transpired with all of that. And Jerry and I were talking on the phone and talking about getting back together. And this was about 2010, 2010. And Jerry and I were talking about getting back together, and he was in Pennsylvania with his father, and he had a massive stroke. And when he went to the hospital for that stroke, of course they do a CAT scan, and they found spots of cancer on his brain. And he had cancer everywhere. He got cancer that started in his liver and moved to his pancreas because he never got his hep C treated. So please, if you have hep C, it's so easy to treat, please get it treated because it can turn cancerous, and that's what happened to him. And so shortly after that, he died, and we never got a chance to get back together. I have a picture of him on my bedroom wall, and I swear at him a lot. I swear at him every time I have to trim the bamboo. I swear at him every time I need to fix the front door. I'm like, where are you? You were supposed to be here with me. That's really hard. And he died in 2011. And I got to talk to him before he died. We got to make amends before he died. We loved each other. I got to talk to Keith, who is he whose name shall not be spoken, the day before he died. And we got to make amends to each other. And we got to forgive each other. And the money and all of that, it didn't matter because it's gone. You know, you got money. When it's gone, it's gone. Yeah. There's no... You know, you'll get more. You'll do something different. It's just how the world works, right? It's not that important. And so I have basically been by myself since 2009. when he whose name shall not be spoken left. Again, because he had met her. And he had met her many times during that relationship. And I kept asking him to come back and asking him to come back. And when he left finally in 2009, I was not going to date anybody else again, ever. And I haven't. And it's 2026, and I am alone. And I can tell you right now, I like being alone. I like being in control of my own life. I like being able to make the decision. I want to buy another Harley. I don't need to ask anybody's permission. I want to get another dog. I don't need to ask anybody's permission. You know, God bless you if you're in relationships and you're happy and you're having fun. Because what I see in most relationships, people are not happy and they're not having fun. It's all about control and manipulation. And I do not want to be maneuvered by any human being ever again. So I live my life, I do my little job, I play with my dogs, I have two dachshunds. And I cannot, my recovery is amazing. My life has been amazing. My life is amazing now. I have this gift of being able to get up in the morning and meditate and thank God. And thank God for the wonderful life that I have. For being able to, for somebody asking me to come here and to speak. You know, somebody asking me to come here and speak. To share my experience, strength, and hope with each other. Right? That means we may solve our common problem and help each other recover from this disease. So if you're new here, or you're coming back, or you've struggled with this thing, there is hope here. That's the message today, is that there is hope. And as a 72-year-old woman that has been there and done that, every single person, and I said this the other day at the meeting, every single person in this room knows the darkness. Everybody in here knows the darkness. And every single person sitting in this room right now is reaching for the light. And so despite what's going on out there in the world, despite all the craziness, the anger, the hatred, the fear, I today decide and make a decision on a daily basis that I am not going to participate in that darkness. I am going to get up and I am going to be loving to you. I am going to be kind to you. I am going to do my best to not judge you. And when you're struggling and upset, I'm going to have the courage to say, are you okay? When you're giving me a dirty look because you're grumpy, I'm going to say, can I help you? Is there anything I can help you with? Do I do that perfectly? No, I'm never going to do that perfectly. I can't. But I know that I am becoming. I'm a better human being than I was when I walked through these doors almost 40 years ago, and I was living in my van with my husband, John, behind the office bar on Lower State Street, where you have to wipe your feet on the way out. It's true. It was a lovely place. We used to start fights. I would start the fight. He would finish the fight. It was fun. It was one of those bars, you know? It was that kind of bar. The Mecca, the back door, Lee John's. Those were fun bars. I loved them. So, you know, there's a part of me, I came here very broken from a childhood that was confusing and abusive and detrimental to my life and detrimental to how I felt as a human being. And you have given me the strength to find some healing from that brokenness. And I recognize there's always gonna be pieces of me that are missing, but there's so many pieces along the way that I have found. And so I, I don't ride bikes anymore, but I paint. It's another discovery that I have found since I got here. I'm an amazing artist, and I didn't know it. Because my mother took my painting when I was little that I gave her to put on the refrigerator, and when I came home at the end of the day, it was in the trash. So I did not pick up a brush until I turned 40. And now the art that I'm painting is just it's God. It has nothing to do with me. And I see that Christ consciousness in those paintings. And I see this parallel universe that I'm painting, and I don't, and I look and I think, who are you? What, where did you come from? Where have you been hidden all this time? And so I encourage you and suggest to you that you find those hidden parts of yourself, that you have the courage to live in that authenticity and to be who you really are without fear, to be who you are coming from a place of love and kindness and understanding. And I'm going to stop, but I want to read something to you that is very special to me. It is not AA sanctioned. And guess what? At almost 40 years, I don't care. There's some license. There's a little bit of license in that. And for those of you that are moms in here, I'm sure you know this book. This is The Velveteen Rabbit. Right? Does anybody know The Velveteen Rabbit? You guys know The Velveteen Rabbit? Okay. What is real? Asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle? Real isn't how you are made, said the skin horse. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. Does it hurt? Asked the rabbit. Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. When you are real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, he said, or bit by bit? It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a really long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes get droopy and hang out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all because once you are real. You cannot be ugly except to people who don't understand. Thank you for listening to me. Let's give Turtle another round of applause.